How much can a box of Oreos reveal about the Vietnamese diaspora in the United States? Food, family, and fitting in all collide in Biet Minh Nguyen's coming-of-age memoir, Stealing Buddha's Dinner. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it has brought it to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
How old were you when you came to the United States?
I was 8 months old.
So this was not a typical immigrant story in the sense that you came here with memories of the homeland and then had to make adjustment.
No, I came here not knowing anything about where I had been born. But in the household, you know, my father, my grandmother, uncles, you know, they carried all their memories from Vietnam. So it presented some confusion for me because I felt like a second generation, but technically I'm first.
They try to create, most immigrants try to create a version of the old country in the new place. But why East Grand Rapids, Michigan? I've been there. I've never been to Saigon, but I suspect that it has little in common with Saigon.
I would say it's probably completely opposite. And we didn't really have too much of a choice. When Grand Rapids was one of the cities that was designated as a resettlement city. And so we ended up there with a couple of the thousand Vietnamese refugees in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. And we were partly sponsored by local Christian churches. And so that's kind of how we ended up there. But it was a shock. The weather was a shock. The cold was a shock, especially for my father and uncles, because you know, they were used to hanging out all day in their shorts. So.
Well, it does get cold in certain parts of Vietnam, but Saigon was in the south, so it was
right.
Kind of warm. I'd imagine that since there were other Vietnamese immigrants, that there was a certain pressure for the community to close the, you know, to be closer for people to cut off from the outsiders. Was that what happened with you?
Well, it was different for me because I was younger and I grew up wanting to be completely American, and English was along with Vietnamese. They were both my first languages. And so what I experienced was not at all what my father and uncles experienced. And they did form a tight bond with the growing community there.
You know, but your father married a woman who's a second-generation Latin American immigrant and a leftist activist. So
yeah.
You were already having a very different kind of experience. Emigre experiences in a sense.
It was lucky that he married her because we really had no idea about how to navigate the American world. You know, school, the systems, all of that. And my stepmother really did. And so she pulled us up.
Still seems like an unlikely marriage.
It is. Yeah, it is. And you know, they met at a New Year's party and fell in love and married very quickly and had a child.
That's your half?
Yes, my half-brother.
Brother.
He calls himself Mexamese.
I see. Well, did you have Spanish food and Vietnamese food when you were growing up?
Well, we did because my stepmother's family, they all live in western Michigan, closer to the lake, Lake Michigan. And whenever we went to their houses, we would have really fantastic Mexican food, a lot of, you know, homemade tortillas and just delicious chicken and rice dishes. But my stepmother didn't really cook that much because she wasn't really a very good cook.
Was the assimilation process harder for her to deal with the Vietnamese family, or for the Vietnamese family, like your grandmother, adjusting to her?
I think it was equally hard both ways, and there was a lot of miscommunication. At some point, there was sort of a mutual breakdown in which my stepmother's family didn't really associate with my grandmother and our family, and vice versa. Because there was a language barrier, for one thing.
And you fell in love with American food.
Yeah.
I used to have a Chinese, a Cantonese landlord who had a restaurant, and he could not understand why, when his kids were exposed to all of that great food, that they preferred to eat at McDonald's and Burger King.
I know, it's a shame. I feel really bad about it now.
But that's what happened with you as well?
Yes.
What is the appeal of that food?
Well, at the time, I mean, this was, you know, the deep 1980s. At the time, American food was normal and exotic, you know, simultaneously. It was what everyone at school was eating. And by not eating it, I was, you know, the misfit. I was out of place. And it also seemed very alluring, you know, all that shiny packaging. They seemed like treasures or like toys. So in a weird way, American food became exotic to me, whereas Vietnamese food was very exotic in Grand Rapids at the time.
So it was foreign food, but it was also a form of a way to assimilate, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
To be like the other kids?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I had a powerful feeling that if I could replicate the lunches of the girls in my class, you know, have those perfect sandwiches, then I could pretend to be one of them.
How did your grandmother react to your wanting American food all the time?
She had a very hard time with it. She really did. And, you know, I look back at that with a lot of regret, because I think I know I hurt her feelings all the time, because I would reject her really good food that I crave now. At the time, though, she was hurt, and finally she would give in a little bit and start making some pseudo-American food. But mostly she stood her ground, and, you know, my uncles would take us out to McDonald's.
As a way of making the kids happy.
Yeah.
Buying the kids off. You write about how you would hoard food as a child. Do you still do that?
I don't have a reason anymore to hoard.
But there it was to slip it by your grandmother?
It was actually mostly to slip it by my stepmother. We had...
she was a leftist activist, so that put a whole other dimension to your life.
She was, but at the same time, she was very concerned with discipline and order. And she brought that into our household, which, you know, I think we needed at the time. But part of the discipline was that we couldn't eat food unless we asked permission for it. And that just drove me crazy, because I was hungry all the time. So I would have to, you know, hoard cookies.
Now, listeners might imagine that you are very overweight, but that's not the case. Were a chubby kid?
No, I wasn't.
My guest is Bitmin Nguyen, and her book, Stealing a Buddha's Dinner, is published by Viking. Were there other things like clothes and music that were as important as ways to assimilate?
Oh, yes, all of it. I mean, clothes, bad fashion, bad music, TV, they were all signposts of the time. And they, you know, they very clearly represented what, you know, a cool, normal person would look like. And I completely bought into the materialism.
Well, what about the non-Vietnamese people you were with? You said you were brought over by a Christian organization, and a lot of evangelicals reject all of that. Did you find yourself, in some cases, having more access to popular culture than some of the kids you went to school with?
Yeah. There's a chapter in Stealing Buddhist Dinner in which I have, you know, I can lord having a Michael Jackson album over my Christian Reformed next-door neighbor who's not allowed to listen to that kind of music.
They would come over to your house to sneak a peek at certain television shows?
And that would be very, very naughty of them.
Were there parts of American culture that your family didn't want you to embrace?
I think that my stepmother and my father were very concerned that I would become a very conservative, Christian Reformed member of the community, because that was the larger dominant community, and they saw how much I wanted to belong. And I think they were worried about that, because those weren't their values, and so I think they were afraid that I would become, you know, different and foreign to them.
Although Vietnam did have a Christian tradition as well, mostly Catholic because of the French presence,
right,
when
mm-hmm.
it was Indochina?
Right, the colonial influence. But my family has, everyone in my family has always been Buddhist.
Are you a practicing Buddhist now?
No, I'm not. I'm not very good at it.
Because of assimilation, do you think?
Because I think that I did not cultivate the discipline it requires. And I do, you know, I do long for a lot of things, and I always have longed for a lot of things, and that kind of goes against what a good Buddhist should be.
My guest is Bit Min Nguyen, her book Stealing Buddhist Drive. Now, Bit is spelled B-I-C-H, and that must have caused you some trouble.
It did. Many, yes. And still does, actually. Still does. I just last week had an incident with someone.
Well, were you tempted, as many immigrants are, to just assume an American name?
Oh, yeah. I tried.
Betty or something?
Betty, Barbara. Actually, at the time, I would have chosen a name like Vanessa or Tiffany. Anastasia. Big names. My parents, really my stepmother, she was absolutely dead set against my changing my name. It would not hear of it, so I was not allowed to do that. And so I never did, and as I went on, I just realized, you know, this is the name that I have, and I could change it, but I would always feel that I had betrayed something in myself.
Although you have changed the order of your name, you've taken the Western style, and because in Vietnam, your name would have been Nguyen Bit Min, wouldn't it?
It is read sort of backwards in Vietnam, but that presents so much confusion in the United States that it's now become the convention to put the first name first.
What about your Latin American stepsister? Did she have adjustment problems to make as well?
My stepsister, Chrissy, is about 5 years older, and I think she was very shocked suddenly to have two younger sisters who followed her everywhere and wanted everything that she had. But she was a really good older sister in that she was very cool, and she knew exactly what to wear and what music to listen to, you know, culture club and so on, and was therefore able to pass down that knowledge to us. But yes, there's a chapter that deals with, you know, my observation of how I felt that she dealt with the confusion, and that was sort of by rebelling a lot against my parents' authority.
Well, the other way that a lot of kids adjust is to go in the other direction and become the best student possible.
Yeah, that was my route.
Did that make you feel like you were assimilating, or did that make you even more of an outsider?
For me, being a good student was about wanting to disappear. And that sort of sounds terrible, because I think it is a terrible impulse. But I thought that if I were a very good child in school, then the teachers would like me, and then I would never get in trouble, and that, you know, everything would be easy. So the motivation was one of erasure more than anything.
So you didn't rebel at all?
That was my form of rebellion, which is strange.
Your sister, stepsister had a problem with shoplifting, didn't she?
She did. She did enjoy, just taking some clothes from the local department stores. And that was, you know, when she was a teenager, she acted out in those kinds of ways.
So what happened with the other Vietnamese students? Did you wind up banding together at times to protect yourselves?
Well, I had very few Vietnamese friends growing up. And the schools... Not by choice, by lack of proximity, mostly. In the schools I attended, there were maybe, you know, one or two other Vietnamese kids my age. And we didn't really band together as much as we might have, I think, because we always felt that we were trying to, you know, band together with other people.
At one point, your school held an assembly to explain Tet, the Vietnamese New Year, to the student body. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that that was a good thing?
At the time, it was really awful, because I played that Neil Diamond song, "We're Coming to America Today." And
there are two reasons to be upset about that. One of them is that it's a Neil Diamond song. Forgive me, Neil, if you're listening.
Well, the entire school was there. This was an elementary school, and, you know, my sister and I had been sent to school that day wearing the áo dài, which is the traditional Vietnamese dress. And we just felt so much on display. And as if we were wearing signs that said, we are the foreigner. And we are the foreigners coming to teach you something. And so that was a very vivid moment in my childhood and my memory that made me, you know, that really signified how I felt all the time.
But weren't you also very obviously the foreigner by what you brought to school for lunch? You
yeah.
say that social status at school was partially transmitted through what you ate at lunch. What
yes.
did you eat?
Well, I didn't bring Vietnamese food to school for lunch, but what I brought never seemed American enough. You know, my sandwiches were never cut as nicely. You know, the bologna was just never as fresh, it seemed. And I think a lot of it was just in my imagination because I was very insecure.
Well, you thought that the households in your neighborhood had sterile rooms and perfect moms.
Yes.
Unlike your family?
And it was so true. Every girlfriend I had, I would go to their house, I would just think about how clean they were. They were so clean. And our house was always sloppy and messy, and we had dogs and dog hair everywhere. And that was normal at home, but I would go out in the world and think, this is really abnormal.
Then you had to go to a white friend's house for dinner. What was that experience like the first time?
This is the chapter called American Meat, in which I go to my best friend's house for dinner, and they have pork chops for dinner. And I'd never had a pork chop before, and I didn't know how to use a knife and fork to cut a pork chop.
But pork is part of the Vietnamese diet. It's just cut up into little pieces?
Yes, my grandmother had never given us a slab of meat to cut into. Everything was already, you know, meticulously sliced up so we could eat with our chopsticks. And so that moment at the dinner table was a terrifying experience where I had to try to pretend that I knew what I was doing. And that, you know, is sort of symbolic of this larger feeling of pretending, feeling like a fraud.
What about being Vietnamese? After all, the memories of what had happened in Vietnam was still fresh, and many people had harbored anger toward Asians in general for all sorts of reasons, especially in the 80s mm-hmm. when Japan was being blamed right. for all the problems in the American economy.
The car industry, yeah. Well, you know, we definitely experienced, you know, some racial slurs and so on. I didn't really understand it at the time, in terms of the political context. All I thought about it was that I looked different and that was wrong. So I took it on very literal terms when I was a child. But then I would also see small moments that revealed something to me that I couldn't understand. Like when my father would go to the paint store to buy paint and his English wasn't perfect and the person behind the counter would make fun of him or would talk down to him. And my father would walk away so frustrated, and he couldn't say anything to anybody.
Often the children in those families wind up having to assume adult roles because they are the translators.
Yes, but my father has and had at the time a lot of pride and would never have asked me to do that.
You spent much of your childhood not knowing where your real mother was and mm-hmm. what had happened to her. When did you finally discover the real story?
Not until I was in college. And when we left Saigon in 1975, it was very last minute, and my father and mother were not together at that time. And so he had to make a decision to leave without her because she wasn't living with us. And that became...
But they were still married.
They were not married. Oh. I always thought they were, but I didn't find out till I was in my 20s that they had never been married. And I didn't know anything about her. She was this mystery, this blankness. And I sort of tried to create that in the book, that we just didn't talk about her and we weren't supposed to talk about her. So there was this enduring silence.
When you go out to eat nowadays, what kind of restaurant do you go to?
I like all kinds of food. In fact, it's really hard for me to choose, especially in New York, because I can eat anything.
Well, also, when we talk about American cuisine, we're really not talking about the same sort of thing as we're talking about when we say Vietnamese cuisine. Even though I'm sure Vietnamese cuisine is regional, there are certain things that are common throughout the country.
Oh, certainly.
Here, American cuisine is Italian, it's Jewish, it's
right.
French, it's English, it's a whole mix of, and Vietnamese,
right.
Thai, Chinese.
And that's so strange to me that Vietnamese food has become American food. I would never have thought that that could happen.
Well, maybe the GIs who fell in love with it when they were there. Have you visited Vietnam?
I did 10 years ago, and I'm planning to go again this year. I have a lot of family there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is tells us a lot about growing up in Michigan, probably as much as it tells us about being Vietnamese. It's called Stealing Buddha's Dinner, a memoir. It's written by Bit Minh Nguyen, who is now living in New York.
I live in Chicago and also teach at Purdue University, so that puts me part-time in Indiana.
And currently at work on a novel.
Yes.
Which will not be like a memoir?
No. Well, it's called Short Girls, and so it's autobiographical in the shortness.
Bittman will be reading and signing books next Tuesday, the 13th, at the Chelsea Barnes & Noble store on 22nd Street and 6th Avenue. That's at 7:30, and it has been my great pleasure to talk to her today about her book, Stealing Buddha's Dinner, which is, it's at 7, I'm told, not at 7:30. The book is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.